Welcome to this episode of Ours to Protect on WLR.
Hi, I'm Clodagh Walsh. Welcome to Ours to Protect 2, our monthly look at climate-related issues. Today, it's the turn of the fashion industry and consumerism. We'll be following the journey of a pair of jeans from clothing bank to, well, let's just see where they end up. And why do we buy so much stuff, so many clothes? What is the need we have to surround ourselves with things? And when did all that start? That's the question I put to sociologist Dr. Jill O'Mahony of SCTU. She teaches a module about consumerism and consumption. So when it comes to our consumption habits, how did we get to where we are?
Before the 1600s, goods were mostly functional. The things that we bought were of necessity rather than anything else. And, there's a lot of reasons for that. In Europe, there is predominantly a feudal system. Capitalism hadn't really, wasn't an economic system at that time. You had monarchies, and identity was given by virtue of those social structures. So by birth, tradition, class, often tied into that monarchical structure. Consumerism was limited. It was the symbolic use of objects were mostly used by kings, the aristocracy, in terms of jewels, elaborate clothing, houses, land, and buildings were really the symbols of status, the symbols of wealth, the symbols of meaning as attributed to you as a person. So up until the 1600s, 1700s, that was the general structure among society. There wasn't really that type of desire to gather lots of things because lots of things meant, extra labour. Lots of things meant extra cleaning. Lots of things were, not a benefit to your life.
Really. And I presume the people who didn't have the money and weren't the kings and weren't the monarchy, they were too busy living. They were probably too busy just getting by day to day.
Absolutely. Their lives were difficult, essentially. So essentially, you're getting up very early. If you're living in an agricultural-based society in a feudal system, you're working the land, you're labouring, whether you're male or female, all of the work that you're engaging in is difficult work. It requires your body to really be engaging in the activity that it's doing, whether it's cleaning, whether it's making food, whether it's preparing food, whether it's mending clothes, whether it's planting crops, whether it's feeding animals, whether it's cleaning yards. And that's the people who were relatively privileged, who had land, who were involved in agriculture.
Right.
And then you have, your peasants, you have people who are grappling and, struggling just to stay alive.
Alive, right. If we move forward a little bit, was it the Industrial Revolution
absolutely.
Or pre that, that consumerism took off because suddenly there were new things?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two main changes in the 1800s. So you've got the Industrial Revolution and what you would often call the Enlightenment, the Age of Enlightenment. Okay, so with the Age of Enlightenment, you had intellectual thinkers, you'd have poets, writers, academics who were starting to question the structure and nature of society, not only in terms of the structure, in terms of the monarchy, the aristocracy, the clergy and everyone else, but also the nature of God, religion, our place in society. So if you look to a lot of the poetry around that time, you can see, and stories written, you can see those questions that are arising from the intellectual set of people, but also those ideas and those concepts start to trickle down. So a good example I usually give in class is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mary Shelley was way ahead of her time when she was questioning the nature of man, the nature of God, and the nature of science. And at the time, that was an absolutely phenomenal and very unbelievable story. But when you think about it now, when we think about the fact that we're trying to resuscitate a human being, it's a similar principle as Frankenstein used to put life into the monster. So, you know, that's a really good idea to have in mind that will show you the types of questions that we're starting to be asked, starting to kind of be uttered amongst the intelligentsia, but also then, as I said, trickling down amongst those who are maybe a slight bit more educated. So there was that, the intellectual awakening, the cultural awakening, you might say, in addition to the Industrial Revolution. And so when we talk about the Industrial Revolution, we're talking about the mechanics of production. So, you know, we're building machines that can handle greater amounts of clothes coming through them, being mended, being created, being woven. You're talking about when that happens, obviously, when machines are able to accommodate a greater amount of product. That means a greater amount of products are being created and being sold. And so buildings will need to be bigger, workforces will need to be bigger. The amount of money being channeled through these businesses, obviously, is going to rise.
It increases. And then I presume that people are working, they're working in those factories. And while either conditions or money,
absolutely,
you know, mightn't be the best, they now have a few bob. They now, it's steady and regular. I'm presuming then that people look to and aspire to and think, well, if I have that, that is kind of status.
Yeah, so a few interesting things happened here. So if you think about the initial factories, they were horrifying places,
right.
Now, to be honest with you. In literature, you might look to north and south and those kinds of debates as to what a person's working life should be. So culturally, you're dealing with the contradiction or the conflict of the upper classes still feeling that the peasantry are less than. They're not worth as much as human beings, and therefore their standard of life shouldn't be as good as people higher up the chain. Throughout the 1800s, you're dealing with those conflicts in terms of the meaning associated with human beings and whether we're worth anything and what we're worth. And so you have the rise of the unions and that kind of thing throughout that time. So while that's all going on, I mean, this is, you know, over 150 years, this type of debate, you have a certain amount of businesses paying a little bit extra. OK, so cut to the turn of the 19th century, going from 1800 into 1900.
Right.
See factories like the Ford factory, who started giving back a little bit extra money to their workers. And suddenly these workers were able to involve themselves in schemes to buy the Model T Ford Lizzie, for example,
right.
Buy the cars, buy nicer houses, wear nicer clothes. And you see people in other factories wondering, well, let's all work for Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Or why aren't we getting paid that much? Yeah. And so Ford, the people running the Ford factories are starting to notice the more we pay them, actually, the more we're making, because this is a form of advertising, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
And also then, I suppose, productivity, because if you feel
absolutely.
I'm getting a few extra bob in my pocket, well, then I am going to work hard and this is a good
absolutely.
Place to work
incentive
for.
Incentive is a really important thing. And everyone wants, exactly as you're saying, everyone wants to work in those types of factories. And so this type of new attitude to capitalism, Fordism, starts to take root. And predominantly in America in the early 1900s. So you've got this absolute change of attitude towards the working person.
Right.
So now suddenly they're not just somebody doing the labor, but they're somebody that is also a consumable product and a consumer themselves.
And as Jill explains, that once we stopped looking at products solely for their use, for their value, and saw them as giving status, well, then everything changed.
So that happened, you know, as we were saying, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the Age of Enlightenment to an extent, but also the beginnings of that started in Elizabeth I's England. When she changed her approach to her subjects, whereby they had to come into court to her and gain her attention if they wanted to maintain her patronage.
So are we looking at things there then, like dress?
Absolutely we are, yeah.
That's amazing.
And so you had these lords coming from the outer reaches of England and Scotland to come in and try and catch her attention. So the better their clothes were, the more exquisite, the more eye-catching colours were changing, the more they were spending on catching her attention, having parties, lavish parties, the more she was likely to give them her favour and maintain the money going into that estate. And the reason she did that was kind of an emulation of what was going on in France, you know, to show mm-hmm. everyone that this Queen of England was far stronger than most of the monarchy in Europe, that she could hold her own, and better than that. Not only could she hold her own, but people would bow to her. People come to see her. People beg her for her favour. And so this type of attitude really kind of inculcated that kind of fervour for products in society. But we're talking about, you know, you might say trickle-down economics. You're talking about trickle-down culture here. So when people at the very top, you know, the landowners are starting to dress in this particular way, what starts to happen all the way down? Because if you're coming into the 1800s and you've got the Industrial Revolution and you've got the Age of Enlightenment where people are starting to feel like they can question, you know, their place yes. in society. Why shouldn't I have nice things? Well, then it starts to become a more spread out cultural phenomenon and not just
that reduced
to the elite. And certain business people like Josiah Wedgwood caught this very quickly and started selling plates and crockery and sending travelling salesmen all around the UK to show the poor people at the bottom.
Then you can have this.
You can have a slice of this. Look at this beautiful crockery here. You can emulate the people at the top, which will mean that you're not quite so low, quite as low
that
as you thought you were.
That there's somebody lower than you are. I'm Absolutely. Thinking as well as materials, because people were making dresses or they were making clothes.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Fascinating.
So initially it started with things like the travelling salesman and the yes. pottery, and then it started to expand out. And so you had, you know, the modern version of department mm-hmm. stores. You might go into London and there are bigger shops and you'll have cheaper versions of clothing, of the material, even if you're just going to get material, because often it was get the really good quality material and you can make the clothes yourself because people were used to doing that. So then it became the material, you know, the really quality material. You get the material from this place, you get the material from that place. And when you've got a colonial country and you're stealing other countries' mm-hmm. resources
and you're
bringing
them in, you
have
all these goods coming in,
you have an awful lot
and you
to
have
choose
choice.
From. Exactly. I suppose in modern society, there are a few things going on. Initially, we have connected status and meaning to consumable products, mm-hmm. to the things that we can buy. Okay, it's the fact that we are attributing identity and meaning to something that we can buy. And that's very modern. Okay, so that's the first thing. And I suppose a question to ask is, why do we have that idea? Why would that have been a concept? Who tells us that? Who tells us that products give us identity?
I think of the advertising
exactly.
that's coming at us and yeah. those influences yeah. and the television and the radio
Absolutely.
And all of those things.
Essentially, that's the answer. So from the very beginning, you're talking about advertising in different ways. So you might have talked about the travelling salespeople for Josiah Wedgwood and those
right.
leaflets that would have been sent around. To the war, you're talking about, well, this will make you a better housewife after the World War, after World War II. This will make you a better American or a better British person. You know, this will make you a better version of who you want to be. And this is what you buy to get that. All of the advertising throughout the whole of the 1900s is very much oriented around developing an identity. So we've gotten to a point now where identity and products are inextricably linked. It's impossible to separate them out now. Even we say we go into a shop, oh, this colour is really me. Well, how can a colour be you unless it's your eyes or your hair,
yes.
in which case many cases it's not. You know, it's the idea that when we're attributing something external to some intrinsic value, it becomes our understanding of ourselves and our place in the world becomes a little bit distorted.
So there you have it. Personal happiness, Social status and identity are closely tied to material possessions. And when it comes to clothes, since the rise of fast fashion and online shopping, the average person owns 60% more clothing than in 2000, and half of us buy clothes several times a month. Now, if like me, you're also fond of a good clear out every now and again, where do you send your clothes? And in turn, where do those clothes end up? Well, a new investigation shows that second-hand garments handed into clothing banks and other take-back schemes are not staying in Ireland, with items being shipped across the world, sometimes ending up in landfill. Sloane Shearer works with Voice Ireland, and she's the project lead on the Threads of Truth project.
We are an environmental NGO. We've been operating in Ireland since, it's been 25 years now. And so we work on waste reduction and circular economy. Those are our main pillars, especially around the SDG 12, which is responsible production and consumption. And so we work across many sectors like, you know, plastic and packaging, food, food waste, textile waste, really anything that is wasted, really. And so our goal is to promote solutions that are respecting the waste hierarchy and promoting a circular economy to be developed in the country. Yes, so this project started a bit more than 7 months ago now, in December 2024, but it follows the release of a report in 2023 called Threads of Transparency, where we looked into the textile waste that is generated in Ireland and what was really happening, because there was very little information about it. And so that's what we highlighted in the report, is that there is very little transparency over how much is actually being discarded, how much is being collected. We have some numbers, but there's no national, you know, record of it. And so we highlighted a number of recommendations to try and bring more clarity in the sector. And since then, there hasn't been like a huge progress. There's been good discussions with the department, but no new, you know, regulations other than the EU ones have come into play. And so we decided in December 2024 to look into this sort of secondhand and textile waste supply chain by using trackers input and sewed in 38 items that we dispatched through either take-back schemes from brands or textile banks that are operated by private companies. We did not use charity operated, you know, textile banks, because we have more records of how much is actually being reused in Ireland from the charities. But private companies, there's very little information. So we decided to track them. And since December, every week, every 2 weeks, we've located each of the items and tracked it and monitored it to sort of see what the journey was, really, and try to identify where, what were the processes and the end fate potentially of these clothes. And at the minute, we have still information on 27 of them.
So let's take a look at one of the 27 items that Solène is talking about, a pair of jeans. This is their journey.
So if we look, for example, the pair of jeans that ended up in Libya, it first was dispatched in Dublin in a clothing bank, and then it went to Poland, which where it most likely was sorted, because Poland is a big hub for sorting secondhand clothes in of all of Europe, really. And then we've tracked it in the Baltic Sea in Germany. Wow. So it was probably on a boat at this point. And then the next time we were able to locate it was in Benghazi port in Libya. And since then, it has traveled to the city of Janzur in Libya. So at the moment, it seems like it might be in a warehouse. So it might be waiting to be either sorted again or, you know, to be sold to then sailors there.
Okay, so it might be sold to sailors there, but it could end up in landfill in Africa or one of the Asian countries?
It could. That's the fear that we have, and I think this project is completely highlighting this possibility for many of the items arriving in Africa. Is that there is no guarantee once they arrive there that it actually will be reused. I think a lot of people don't realize the amount of clothes that is being exported to these countries, and so what we have from organizations working on the ground there is that about 40% of what they receive will end up as waste, either because they are waste in the first place and we tend to export waste illegally under the label of reusable, or simply because it won't be sold and then there's no other countries to export it to. So it will end up in landfill.
The fashion industry is a major contributor to global emissions. It is one of the most environmentally damaging. It's ranked fourth for climate impact, third for water and land use, and fifth for raw material use and greenhouse gas emissions. Solène.
The textile industry, the fashion industry as a whole, is a very unregulated industry. And when it comes to waste, it's even more, because there's not even a proper definition of what textile waste is. So we don't, if you don't name something, then you can't really deal with it properly. Right. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is that no, there's no regulations around how should we sort it, what should be named what, how do we retain what is actually waste, and then there's no regulation about where it ends up. So there is one regulation about that we're not supposed to export waste, right?
Yes.
Outside of the EU. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, because there's no way of actually saying what is waste and what is not, companies are at the moment free to label anything reusable or potentially, you know, for repurposing.
Right. So that's the loophole, isn't it?
Yes, yes, that's it.
Yeah, and I know that from January of this year that there has to be separate collection of textiles, that became mandatory in EU countries. But you feel that this will lead to increased volumes of clothing for export?
Yes, because at the moment in Ireland, 65% of all discarded clothes are just going through the black bin. So it's not even being collected. So that's this amount, these 65% that this law is supposed to be capturing in a separate way. So Ireland should be providing this separate collection. But that means that everything that is going through the black bin at the minute is probably very low quality, probably not reusable. Right. And we still don't have any concrete ways
numbers
of dealing
it.
With it.
Yeah.
And we don't have any proper sorting facility, in Ireland that is publicly owned or semi-public. There's no way of tracing the clothes and making sure that they're actually recycled if we export it. So it's just that this is a good way to say we should be separating this particular material. But the thing is that there's nothing around it to make sure that it doesn't get exported as waste.
You can check out the live tracker of where those clothes are going on Voice Ireland's website. Now, it's going to run until November of this year, and the final analysis will support recommendations to increase transparency and environmental standards in used textile collection and trade. So before throwing out an item of clothing, the charity recommends trying to repair it first. And when it comes to donating garments, charity shops are best.
When we opened, it was an awful lot of people balked at the idea. I mean, they wouldn't have been, especially in rural countryside, wouldn't be familiar with charity shops, wouldn't be familiar with, you know, they just kind of go, oh my God. In a village, somebody's going to be seen going down wearing somebody else's jumper next week. Like, you know, that was the fear, you know, who's going to go in there? And there was an awful lot of snobbery against it.
That's Helen Ridgard of the Sunflower Shop in Kilmac Thomas, and she's talking there about when they started off first.
Now the shop is run as a social enterprise, but it did start as a charity shop, and all of their proceeds go to the Waterford Hospice movement. So have attitudes changed since they started? Helen picks up the story.
We've just found over time now, like especially with the younger kids, like the kids when I opened are now in St. Declan's, you know what I mean? They're all in transition year, and over the years we've had a lot of the transition year students in helping out and stuff, and the whole attitude has changed because they've been coming in here since babies, like with their grannies who's coming in for some maybe a few toys or something because they've nothing in their house. And it's so much easier for people to come in with little kids, little 2 euros and 3 euros, don't know the difference between my toy area and Smith's. They just see toys. And you can get a tie for a euro, 2 euro, and they are made up going out, and they feel like they're spoiling them because the kids are so happy, and it's just, and that's over time they've grown up with that, and people have got used to it now. So there's a different attitude. Same with the clothes, the bric-a-brac. People are saying, you know, why would you go into town and spend a fortune on a few mugs if you need a few, you know what I mean, when you can get a few mugs here, because people have too much stuff.
And things certainly have changed. The Sunflower Shop, like a lot of charity shops around, they now have a special room dedicated to maybe what we could call once-off clothing, something you might buy for a wedding, a Deb's dress, a communion dress. Helen again.
Even with the ordinary dresses, if you go to a wedding and, you know, you've worn the dress to a wedding, then you've worn it to another occasion, the chances are you'll probably wear it 2 or 3 times. And then yourself, you don't feel, you know, you want to wear it anymore. They say, oh God, they'll see me in that dress again. But it comes in here, it goes off to another part of the county or whatever. And so, and you know, it's not going to, and even clothes look different on other people. So, you know, people don't recognize it or won't recognize it, but the chances are at another wedding, who's going to see it? And it's perfect. I mean, that dress might have cost 140 euro and you get it here for 12. With the Deb's dress is the same. I mean, I had a few people in now earlier on in the year, and what I do is I just have the book by appointment to come up here. And I just left them up here. They went through themselves. And it's amazing the different styles, because any style will do in for Deb's now. Even if it's old, they say it's vintage. They're delighted with it. You know, it's a vintage Deb's dress from the 80s or the 90s or whatever, and they get a right kick out of it. We do 30 euro as a standard price on all of that room. So like there's dresses, you know, that people have paid a fortune for, and they're getting another wear.
I'm sure many of you, like me, have gone to your local charity shop with a bag or a couple of bags and only to be told they have no space. So what happens then? This is what they did in Kilmack.
Now, we had a big event here. We got so much stuff. And as I said, I hate getting rid of stuff. I really do want to find homes. So we found there in this summer, we had an awful lot of stuff. And I was actually talking to this lady from America, and she had some stuff she wanted to give me. And I said, I actually don't have the room for it. And she said, I can give you a rail. And I said, I don't have the room for a rail. And she just said to me, she said, well, what they do in America in the thrift shops, she said, is when they get overloaded with stuff, they have a bag sale. You have the bag and you pay a few dollars for the bag and people go in and just fill their bag up. And I said, that's a brilliant idea. So we did a fiver a bag, and you could come into the shop and fill it with whatever you wanted. And we had no idea how it was going to go. And we opened it. We opened between 11 and 3. So we don't get tired of it because we volunteer and we don't want to get sick of it either. So we keep it short so that we're happy in here and we're all enjoying it. When we opened the door at 11 o'clock, there was a queue down the street waiting, and the kids were jumping up and down with excitement. I mean, the whole street was talking about it. They were all queued down the street. The cars were over the bridge, and we opened the door and we got let in so many, and then we had to do one in, one out, and everybody was going out with their bags full of stuff, and they were just so excited and absolutely loved it. And it cleared a load of space for us.
Too much stuff. A recent Environmental Protection Agency found, actually, that 73% of people want reassurance that their unwanted clothes aren't ending up in landfill abroad. So the next time you're discarding clothes, just stop and think where they might end up. And that's it for this month from Ours to Protect Too. My thanks to all the contributors who took part, and I'll talk to you again at the end of October. For now, bye-bye.
Ours to Protect, brought to you by WLR, the IBI, and funded by Commission Oman, with the television license fee. For more info, see the sustainability page on WLRFM.com.